Okay, good evening, everyone. Tonight we have the distinct privilege to learn about one of the great rabbis of the, as we'll see, as the 20th century, and end of the 19th, beginning of 20th century. And I hope, my goal is that by the end of the night, you will be as moved by Rabbi Eliezer Silver, the life that he lived, and all of his great accomplishments, as I was, as I learned about him. I want to start off with two stories that I think each touch upon a little bit of his life. One is more famous, the other is a little bit less famous. And hopefully, it'll give us a little bit of appreciation about the person we're going to speak about tonight. The first story is a very famous one, that Rabbi Eliezer Silver was in a car on the way to the airport. He was in a taxi. In fact, Rabbi J.J. Schachter just told me that his father, Rabbi Herschel Schachter, was in the back seat of the car, so he personally vouched for the story. But on the way to the airport, they were pulled over by a policeman. And the policeman wanted to give him a ticket for speeding, so the taxi driver looks over at the policeman and says, Officer, you can't give us a ticket. Do you know who's sitting next to me? This is the chief rabbi of America. And all of a sudden, piping up next to the taxi driver, Rabbi Eliezer Silver pipes in and says, and Canada. Second story is Rabbi Schachter told me that his father once asked Rabbi Eliezer Silver, who was famous for not sleeping a lot. He only slept about 3 hours a night. So Rabbi Schachter's father asked him, he said, how is it that you only sleep 3 hours a night? So Rabbi Eliezer Silver looked back at him and said, well, you see, I'm a genius, and genius does everything very fast. So who is this person who has that sense of wit, that sense of confidence in what he's able to accomplish? And what we'll learn tonight is Rabbi Eliezer Silver wasn't just a great individual, but he was able to blend multiple worlds. And in that regard, I would humbly suggest we, in our day and age, are desperately in need of a Rabbi Eliezer Silver. He served as a link between European rabbis and American rabbis. He served as a link between the Mizrahi Zionist movement, between the Aguda movement. Who is this man who both had a very close relationship with Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski, the great Posek Hador, the greatest rabbi, arguably, of the previous generation, and also with Robert Taft, the president's son? Who is this person who was able to walk in very different worlds and do so with enormous amount of grace and also success? A lot of what we will discuss tonight is from Rabbi Rakefet's book called The Silver Era. Some of you may have seen it, some of you might own it, and I will glean a lot from that book. A lot of the other stuff that I will glean, you'll see, is by a book that Mrs. Morris, obviously Mrs. Malcolm Morris, is Rabbi Eliezer Silver's granddaughter, and she shared a book with me where in the introduction, Rabbi Eliezer Silver shares a lot about his work. I will call a little bit from that. And again, my goal tonight is not just to bring him to life, but to show what made him unique. And for me personally, it's a model of the rabbinate. It's a model of leadership, which I desperately think our day and age is in need of. So Rabbi Eliezer Silver was born in 1882, dies in 1986 to Rabbi Bunim Tzemach in Malka. What did I say? Yeah, that would be 1968. What did I say? 1868? Yeah, 1968. To Rabbi Bunim and Tzemach in Malka Silver. You'll notice the name Malka Silver, which is Malka Morris, is named after her great-grandmother. Okay, he was born in Abo, which was near Kovno in Lithuania, and his father, his father starts off in business and then succeeds him as the rabbi in Dusa, which is right here. It's in the northern part of Lithuania. Okay, his education is unique. And to me, this is really where you get a little bit of a glimpse as to what makes him so special. Rabbi Eliezer Silver is educated first by his father. Up until, certainly for the first number of years of his life, he is educated primarily by his father. And he goes to Dvinsk, where he learns with Rav Meir Simcha Cohen of Dvinsk, also known to us, as the Meshech Chachma that you have here. What's interesting is that he also learns with Rabbi Yosef Rosen, who's known as the Rugachever, who is a Hasidic Rebbe. So you see off the bat that his education is interesting. A year later, he moves to Vilna, where he learns under Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski, again, who I pointed out, is arguably the greatest rabbi of the previous generation. And subsequent to that, in 1900, he goes to Brisk, where he learns with Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik. Needless to say, this is an incredibly impressive list of gedolim for Rabbi Eliezer Silver to be educated under. Okay, and what will make him unique, as we will see, was that despite the fact that this was his educational model, he comes to America and is able to adapt it for American culture. That is definitely something unique. So you have Rav the Rugachever, you have the Meshech Chachma, you have Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski, who we'll learn a lot about tonight, and you have Rabbi Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. Okay? He was an Eloi from a very young age, and one day he comes to the Strashen Library of Vilna, where he sees a beautiful woman there. And as opposed to the common practice of the time, he does not go through a shidduch process, but he actually meets his wife, his first wife, in a natural way. His first wife dies at a very young age, and he will go on to later remarry. While he is born in Lithuania, he ultimately comes to America in 1907. And while he comes to America, he carries with him a letter of recommendation from Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski. Now, as opposed to many people who, when they're threatened with draft into the Russian army, they use their an exemption to get out of it, Rav Eliezer Silver felt that it was more important. He goes to America. Listen to the letter of recommendation from Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski. He says the following: the erudite Rabbi Eliezer Silver, son of the Gaon Rabbunim Tzemach of Dusat, has studied in our kibbutz for exceptional students over these past few years. Kibbutz here is not kibbutz in the way we refer to it, but it's basically a kollel. His diligence was superb, and he became an expert in the entire Talmud in cognate literature. His high level of knowledge is only equaled by his deep love for Torah. It is superfluous for me to declare how grateful I will be for assistance extended to this Torah personality. I will cherish and honor those who seek the welfare of Torah and its adherents. That is a pretty impressive letter of recommendation from Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski. When he gets to America, so he gives a lecture at Reitz. Reitz at the time was on the Lower East Side. And he gives a shiur, right, a shiur in Gemara. And at the end of the shiur in Gemara, it is recorded that someone says the following: what a shame that such a fine scholar chose to emigrate here. America will destroy him, while in Europe, he would have become a Torah sage. Right? America will destroy him. And to me, the greatest success of Rav Eliezer Silver was that not only did America not destroy him, but as we'll see, he grew into a gadol in America. And that is actually what makes him unique amongst so many other rabbanim. Other rabbanim that I have personally taught here, and again, I would imagine many of the others, they were great rabbis. They were great pulpit rabbis. I'm not mocking pulpit rabbis, right? Rav Eliezer Silver becomes the first American gadol in America, and we'll study about that in just a little bit. When he first comes, he sells insurance. He is unsuccessful in that, ultimately goes bankrupt, and he is offered a position at JTS, where he meets with Professor Solomon Schechter. And what Rabbi Eliezer Silver noticed immediately is that Professor Schechter does not wear anything on his head. And he decides that that's not the place for him, and he passes up the position. After a short stint in New York, the Silvers moved to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, where he receives a grand total salary of $6 a week. Yeah. Stays there until 1925, and while there are multiple shuls in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania that he is in charge of, ultimately he is afforded a lot of time to study and to learn. And in that regard, I say that it is in America that it becomes the first American Gaon. Really the first American gadol b'Torah, because he is able to dedicate so much of his time to learning while in Harrisburg. In fact, the story is told that he went into one shul where he used to study for a long period of time until the president of the shul came and kicked him out. Told him he's not allowed to study there anymore. He's not allowed to learn there anymore. Why? because the vision of a rabbi mumbling to himself for hours on hours on end, the optics of it aren't good to the non-Jews who are walking by. It's pasnished. It was embarrassing for the shul. And so the president limited him to how much he could learn in that shul during the day. Rav Elaz Silver never returned to that shul again. He was so turned off by that experience. But again, he became the first internationally renowned American rabbi. Now, someone who became a gaon in America. And of course, that's going to change after World War II with the influx of European rabbis, and that will ultimately shift the balance of power. Not everyone loved that he was learning so much. One rabbi, one lay leader at the time was quoted as saying, if he is so learned, then why must he continue studying? Right? Why does my rabbi spend so much time learning? Shouldn't he be doing other things? After 1925, in between the two world wars, Rabbi Silver takes up a position in Springfield, Massachusetts. Springfield, Massachusetts at the time was a vibrant Jewish community. It was interesting. I was listening to something by Rabbi Rakefet, who again wrote the book, literally, on Rabbi Eliezer Silver. And he misspoke about the relationship between Rabbi Eliezer Silver and the Rav. He goes, oh, but Rabbi Eliezer Silver was in Springfield. That's right next to Boston. Springfield is not right next to Boston, for those who need a geography lesson. But nonetheless, in Springfield, he succeeds in raising the kashrus standards. He is successful in raising the standards for milah and for mikvah. I want to share with you a little bit of a quote. This is from the Journal of Hapardes, where it talks about kashrus in America in 1928. Listen to the disastrous state of kashrus that existed back then. Says Hapardes, the article, an editorial. In many ways, Jewish life has undergone radical change in the United States. Nothing has been altered more than the position of the shochet. In the old home, this profession was considered a sacred calling. The shochet was granted clergy status as a designated individual properly discharging his holy task. The European shochet did not view his profession as simply a business to enable his learning. He rather completely dedicated himself to Torah and tradition, carefully following the dictates and rulings of the rabbis. Never did the shochet act on his own without rabbinic approval. Here in America, the situation is completely different. The shochet simply considers his vocation a means of attaining a livelihood. It is simply another profession amongst many. His fondest wish is to join a union so his salary will be increased. In many cities, the shochetim have already organized and worked together with union bosses. So you see that shechita went from the European country where it was a job held in high esteem for pious, learned individuals, to all of a sudden in America became a business like any other. And you and I know that when you mix business with kashrus, oftentimes, without a body to govern it, what happens? Not good things. Rabbi Eliezer Silver, one of the things that he dedicated so much of his time, both in Springfield and later in Cincinnati, as part of his endeavors with the Agudas HaRabbanim, which we'll talk about in a little bit, was to raise the level of kashrus, of milah, of mikvah usage. There was an enormous amount of ignorance amongst Rabbanim in America at the time. And one of the things that Rabbi Eliezer Silver dedicated his life to was raising the level of religious observance in America. 1931, he comes to Cincinnati, Ohio, where he will remain for the rest of his life. Now, Cincinnati, Ohio, as you know at the time, is the home to Hebrew Union College, the bastion, the center of Reform Judaism. And we'll see that's going to actually play a significant role in Rabbi Eliezer Silver's rabbinate and in the influence that he's able to achieve in American society. One of the first things that he does when he moves to Cincinnati is he's unhappy that the mikveh is in the old, decrepit part of the city, and so he moves it to the newer part of town. Where does he build it? In literally the fanciest neighborhood in Cincinnati, right next to the leading Reform temple. And as you can imagine, the Reform Jews go crazy, right? What is this? We're not in Europe anymore, we're in America. So what do they do? Right? What do you do if you don't want someone to move next door? You sue. Right? They sued Rabbi Elazar Silver. What does Rabbi Elazar Silver do to defend the mikveh there? He employs the services of none other than Robert Taft, the gentleman right here, the son of President Taft. They were long-time friends. They were lifelong friends. And Rabbi Elazar Silver writes 10 reasons why mikveh usage is so important for Judaism. The 10th reason is because women go there, it promotes marital intimacy. And Robert Taft responds and says that I think that that 10th reason is the most important. And therefore, he goes to court. When the Reform Jews see who's representing Rabbi Elazar Silver, they immediately back down, recognizing that they are not going to be successful in this court case. This was before he was a senator. He was a lawyer at the time. They recognized that they would not be successful. And he subsequently sent a bill to Rabbi Elazar Silver. This isn't the actual bill, but I wanted to give you an image to go with. Right, a bill for $4,000 and a receipt, right, and a receipt for the same sum. In other words, he wasn't going to charge it. He was doing it entirely per diem. Rabbi Elazar Silver also went to bat for a number of other causes in, what?
Per bono.
Right? He also went to bat for a number of other causes in Cincinnati. For example, when religious students in the Cincinnati Medical School were forced to take tests on Shabbos and Yontif, he fought them, even though the dean of the medical school said he will never, as a result, bring in another religious student. He had such a bad experience. But nonetheless, those students that were already there were given the opportunity to take the tests, not on Shabbos. And in many regards, that laid the groundwork for so much of what we benefit nowadays of the religious accommodations that we benefit with to this day. What I want to spend the rest of our time doing is highlighting the achievements. The key, if I had to boil down the three key achievements of his life, I will say it is as part of the Agudas HaRabbanim, later as part of the Agudas Yisrael, and perhaps most importantly, his work in the Vad Hatzalah. So let's go one by one. Did I skip? I skipped some of my stuff. Okay. Let's go one by one. Okay. Agudas HaRabbanim. Okay. Agudas HaRabbanim was founded in 1902 in America to unite the European rabbis. In 1929, Rabbi Elazar Silver is appointed as the head of the Agudas HaRabbanim. And immediately, there is a tension between the European rabbis and what we'll call the American-trained rabbis. One of the things Rabbi Elazar Silver does is he seeks to preserve the integrity of the Agudas HaRabbanim by blocking rabbis who he doesn't think are qualified enough to be part of this institution. In fact, Rabbi Rakefet points out in his book that the beginnings of the RCA were those rabbis that were excluded from the Agudas HaRabbanim because they didn't meet the level that he wanted to include. Nonetheless, he uses this body of the rabbinate to strengthen the level of kashrus in America, and it's the first foray into political activism. So, in June 12, 1912, he performs his first national function. He's part of a delegation that goes to visit William H. Taft, who's the President of the United States, to encourage a more rigorous policy in protest against Russia and their persecution against the Jews. At that meeting, there was a debate amongst the Rabbanim whether or not to wear their hats. Ultimately, they decided that they were going to wear their hats because they wanted to make a bracha, Shemu Malchus, at the site of meeting the president. So moved was President Taft at seeing these rabbis with their hat on that he too, at a sign of respect, chooses to don a hat at the experience. But that was really his first foray into political activism. In 1912, Agudas Yisrael is founded to safeguard halacha against reform, against assimilation, and against socialistic trends. Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski is the head of the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah, which is the rabbinic board governing this body. Rabbi Elazar Silver, in 1933, declares the following, and I brought the quote for you here because you have to see it for yourself to appreciate just how beautiful this quote is. Rabbi Elazar Silver was not just affectionate towards the Agudas Yisrael, as we'll see in a second, but he was also involved in Mizrahi, the Zionist movement. He attended their conferences, he attended their conventions, he raised money for their drives. And in 1933, he says the following: "We must bring about a meeting in Eretz Yisrael of all the heads of world orthodoxy. In cooperation with the rabbinic and lay leaders, we should unify the Mizrahi and Agudas Yisrael. Perhaps we can arrange for a central authority for all orthodoxy. We must no longer suffer from disunity." It's quotes like that that I share with you when I say that we need more leaders like this nowadays. Now, obviously, right, Agudas Yisrael looked a lot different back then than it does nowadays. But Rav Chaim Moser Grzinski categorically rejected any movement to bring together Mizrahi and the Agudas Yisrael. Why? One of his stipulations was that Mizrahi had to leave the World Zionist Organization and the Jewish Agency Education and Culture Committee, which is obviously supporting non-religious education. Mizrahi rejected both, and we, to this day, are left with an enormous schism. But one is left to wonder, what would have happened had those bodies been able to get together and had those bodies been able to work together? 1937, famously, we've discussed this in many of these classes before, is the last gathering of Agudas Yisrael and Marienbad before the Holocaust. Rabbi Lezer Silver attends that convention, and he addresses it by saying the following. And again, I think it's such a beautiful speech. He says, "Now I must speak for my American colleagues. My words have the approval of the Gaon Rav Chaim Moser. For the first time, I will make a request from you. We, the United States, are constantly answering your appeals for financial aid. We support your charity funds, Talmud Torahs, and yeshivas. Now, we request that you start to repay us by inspiring us with your spirit. In other words, we've given you a lot of money, but now we want you to give us ruchnius, spirituality. Let each of your Torah scholars visit us once, not to raise funds, but rather to intensify American Torah life." Right? In other words, you only call upon me for money, but now I need something in return. I need you to import your Torah wisdom. Why have you deserted almost a third of your people? We have sowed and planted yeshivas and other Torah institutions. We have fought for kashrus and family purity. However, we are now weak. Again, this is in 1937, right? We are weak. Come and implant a new spirit within us. Nevertheless, only send us Torah leaders steeped in learning and fear of God. Only such gaonim can be influential in the United States. With such an approach, you will repay us for what we have done for you over the last number of years. Right? Isn't that an amazing statement? And as we're happy to raise money for you, all we want, all American society is craving, is a connection to authentic Torah. He goes on to say, "This international rabbinic body should consist of two or three preeminent Torah scholars from each country, regardless of whether they are affiliated with Aguda or Mizrahi. They should confer on to how to strengthen Torah observance in the yeshivas. They should also express their viewpoints regarding Eretz Yisrael." Again, this is his call for an international rabbinic committee to strengthen Torah. Okay? At that meeting, in 1937, Rav Chaim Moser Grudzinski pulls over Rav Lezer Silver and encourages him to import Agudas Yisrael to America. Rav Chaim Moser said in a letter, "I arrived in Vilna, and even the Gentiles knew where Rav Grzinski was. They directed me to a summer residence which was outside the city proper. The Gaon received me with great joy. He explained the inner workers of Agudas Yisrael and delegated me to represent him at the meeting of the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah. Every spare moment was utilized for Torah discussion and Talmud analysis. My greatest joy was Shabbos afternoon. I spent the entire day learning with him." So Rav Chaim Moser used that as the opportunity to encourage him to start an Agudas Yisrael here in America. Okay? And that ultimately is what he successfully does. Rav Chaim Moser, after the convention, he begins with the Rav behind him, ironically, He launches Agudas Yisrael in America, and the first convention is held in Farakway, New York, in 1939. The second convention is held in Cincinnati in 1940. Now you can imagine, Cincinnati is the home of Reform Judaism. And here, Rav Eliezer Silver brings the second Agudas convention to the center, the home of Reform Judaism, and the Reform Jews again go crazy. This is America. This isn't Europe. Let me share with you a quote of the vision that people, this is from Hapardes, describing the sight of rabbis leaving the shul. They said the following: the main synagogue was filled beyond capacity. The Rabbanim and Hasidic leaders sat in the front of the eastern wall. Their patriarchal look and venerable rabbinic garb cast an aura of sanctity throughout the entire sanctuary. The regular worshippers rejoiced in the sight. The Jewish people have not been left leaderless, even in this derelict generation. The congregants blessed the Lord for having spared illustrious spiritual leaders for our times. Rav Eliezer Silver writes an open letter. This is already a few years back when he's beginning the Agudas Yisrael. And he says the following, as when he makes the argument for why Agudas Yisrael is so important. He says, how much longer can we stand apart? I'm sorry, how much longer will we separate ourselves from these leaders of Torah? In other words, we should start an Aguda to link ourselves with the Gedolim of Europe. How can we continue to stand apart as our masters are opposed and censured by those outside the Aguda camp? Could it not be we do not choose to be with Reb Chaim Moser, Reb Menachem Zemba, and the Ger Rebbe? The time has come for us to declare our allegiance to Agudas Yisrael. My brothers, the time has come to overcome our hesitations and to unite with Gaonim of the world. That is his argument for the importance of Agudas Yisrael. At the second convention, who is there? Some notables like Rav Shlomo Hyman, Rav Moshe Feinstein. I don't know who Rav Chaim Korb of Chicago. I don't know who that is. HTC. Anyone know the name? Anyways, and Korb. He was the Rosh Yeshiva of Beis Medrash LaTorah. Okay, thank you. And who gives the eulogy? Rav Chaim Moser passes away. Who gives the eulogy for Rav Chaim Moser there? Rabbi Soloveitchik. That's a very famous eulogy that Rabbi Soloveitchik gives, where he points out that the Kohen Gadol has two distinct garments. One is the tzitz, right over here, and the other is the choshen, the ephod, right? He points out that this, the tzitz, stands above the head, whereas the ephod, the choshen, is on the heart. And the Rav says the following: each vestment had a different function. The gold plate, namely the tzitz, is entirely sacred, was placed upon the forehead, the seat of wisdom and knowledge. The breastplate was placed upon the heart of Aaron, the center of love and affection for the Jewish people. The gold plate, entirely holy to the Lord, guided the Jews in purely spiritual matters. The breastplate, on the other hand, answered inquiries of political and social nature. Throughout the millennium, the true heads of Jewish people were their spiritual leaders. They provided guidance in both spiritual and temporal matters. Rav Chaim Moser was the prime example of such total leadership in our times. In other words, Rav Chaim Moser didn't just have knowledge in his head, but he had a connection to the people that he served in his heart. He was with it, so to speak. And therefore, he had a sense of politics and a sense of earthly matters. Continues the Rav, recently a viewpoint is being fostered upon the Jewish community. The claim is now being made that rabbis only decide purely spiritual questions. Other areas are the prerogative of political leaders of the Jewish people. Rav Chaim Moser valiantly fought against that standpoint during his lifetime. At this moment of eulogy for him, we likewise must demand that political leadership be returned to the true heads of our people, the principal rabbis of our generation. The breastplate must once again be reunited with the plate of pure gold. That is a description of what you and I would colloquially refer to as Das Torah. Das Torah, which means that I don't just go to my Rav for halachic knowledge, but that because a Rav is so steeped in Torah, he has a level of insight, a level of wisdom that surpasses even those that are involved in politics. Okay, that is ironically a description of the Rav of a very, what we'll call Haredi talking point, called Das Torah. Afterwards, after the second Aguda convention, Rav Chaim, Rav Elezer Silver issues a press statement. And I want you to listen to the words of the press statement and understand that him hosting the convention in Cincinnati was not an accident. It was part of his battle against reform to strengthen orthodoxy in America. He says, "A miracle took place in Cincinnati. The capital of Reform Jewry and assimilation became a center of dedicated and uncompromising Torah Judaism." You know what that's called? Taking it right to them. Right? Taking it right to them. Agudas Yisrael conquered the city. Reform Jews were surprised when they saw so many bearded Jews with payas wearing long black coats. The singing and the dancing on the lawn of the synagogue upset their complacent sense of assimilation. Right? You get a little bit of a sense of the fight, of the tenacity, of the guts, of the fearlessness that Rabbi Eliezer Silver would be known by. He says, "The time has come." Again, this is comes back to a quote I shared earlier. "The time has come for the Aguda and Mizrahi to declare a truce." Right? How many Gedolim would call for that? Right? We have to call a truce. "Although the Aguda is daily gaining strength in the United States, we still publicly stress our peaceful intentions. We should together advocate the study of Torah and the observance of mitzvos. Our mutual commitment unites us, and we should rather oppose those who entirely uproot our tradition." Simply put, his argument is that the whole is stronger than the sum of the individual parts. So you could have Mizrahi, and you can have Aguda working separately from one another, but if we really want to conquer assimilation, if we really want to strengthen traditional Judaism, then we're much better off working together and in concert with one another than against one another. Rabbi Rakefet quotes Rabbi Eliezer Silver as saying that Aguda is his elder sister and Mizrahi is his younger sister. Now we will see that this changes. That while Rabbi Eliezer Silver favors a big tent, something again that I personally believe is desperately needed in America in our day and age, nonetheless, we will see that by the end, Rabbi Eliezer Silver, the Aguda that he strengthened, turns on him in a little bit, in subtle ways, in ways that after the European rabbis come to America, and Aguda takes a little bit of a different turn than it was at the time that he wrote things like that. So we will, let's continue though for now. That's Aguda in America. Then we come to the Vat Hatzalah. This to me is nothing short of extraordinary. And I want to share with you a quote by Rabbi Soloveitchik that was given in December 24th, 1973 at a public lecture, where the Rav says the following: "To the list of al-chaitz, of the chataim, the sins, we enumerate on Yom Kippur, we should add another al-chait. Perhaps it would be the worst, the most horrible one." What is this al-chait that Rabbi Soloveitchik says we should add to the liturgy on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur? I'm sorry, on Yom Kippur. "Al-chait shechatanu lefanecha, for the sin that we have sinned before you. Be ra'inu tzoros nafshoseihem, that we saw the suffering, shel achenu beis Yisrael, of our brothers and sisters in Israel," right? "Who were called to us, velo shamanu, and we did not hear their calls." That is Rabbi Soloveitchik in 1973 giving an indictment of the entire generation that lived in the Holocaust and largely did nothing to help the Jews of Europe, with one exception, and that is Rabbi Eliezer Silver. We have spent so much time in various courses over the years talking about the absence of American Jewry, in the silence of American Jewry, And to me, that makes what we're about to speak about in the next couple of minutes nothing short of heroic and simply amazing and incredible, and I'll even use the word mind-boggling, of what Rabbi Elazar Silver is able to accomplish on behalf of saving Jewish lives. Tireless, literally tireless efforts to save as many Jews as he possibly could. 1939, Rabbi Elazar Silver founds the Vad Hatzalah. Others involved, famous names are Irving Bunim from the Young Israel, Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein, and Michael Tress from the Aguda. Rabbi Elazar Silver decides that one of the things they have to do is they have to get boots on the ground, so to speak. In other words, they need eyes and ears to know exactly what's going on. And so he wants to send someone to Europe to meet with Reb Chaim Ozer Grudzinski to get a sense of exactly what's going on. So who does he send? He sends Dr. Shmuel Samuel Schmidt, who's the editor of Cincinnati's Every Friday, which was a prominent newspaper in Cincinnati. Dr. Schmidt is not religious. He's a secular Jew. He's a Zionist. He's a labor Zionist. He's the head of Board of Health in Cincinnati, and he sends him specifically to Vilna. Don't think that that is an accidental choice. Right? Don't think that's an accidental choice. There is a lot of chachma in choosing someone who's not necessarily in the bubble to go. Dr. Schmidt comes to Reb Chaim Ozer Grudzinski, and Reb Chaim Ozer says, "Can I call you Reb Shmuel?" He says back to him, but I have the quote here. This is Schmidt writing back a letter about his experience. He says, "After I told Rabbi Grudzinski of my mission, he asked that I tell him about myself. I broke down like a Jew on Yom Kippur and told him about my entire life and the causes I previously espoused. When I finished, Reb Chaim Ozer gently placed his hand on my shoulder. He asked whether I would permit him to address me as Reb Shmuel in the traditional fashion. I answered that I'm not worthy of such an honor. Reb Chaim Ozer, however, insisted that I am. He claimed that I proved myself by leaving the security of the United States and journeying to a war zone to aid my brethren. At that moment, I became another person. I became Reb Shmuel." Such mussar. He started the newspaper. He started the newspaper. Right? It's a beautiful, really beautiful story. Anyways, 1940, in a communication printed, he writes the following. This is of the Every Friday, talking about what's going on in Europe. He says, "The heroism of the Yeshiva Bachram in fleeing to Vilna to pursue the ideals cannot be overestimated. In general, the way the yeshivas managed to settle here is nothing short of a miracle. The yeshivas themselves, as an institution, remaining untouched and unblemished, entirely immune to the ravages of time and events, are a miracle." In other words, he appreciated the Mesiras Nefesh of the students, of people who are dedicating themselves to the learning. Okay. They begin send money to Europe. And they are able at first to get a lot of Rabbanim out of Europe. This is just some of the telegrams. You can find them online. This is a plea for help, right? We are in Lithuania. Urgent help necessary. Address to Rabbi Silver. Again, you have a similar, I cut it off over here, but a similar telegram to the Vad Hatzalah. Who are some of the most notable people that the Vad Hatzalah is successful at saving? Well, first you have Rav Aaron Cutler. Inarguably, no one has changed the face of American Jewry more in the past 50, 60, 70, 80 years than Rav Aaron Cutler, certainly changing the face of the Torah world. He was also able to save the Ger Rebbe, right? The Ger Rebbe he's able to save. And again, we all know the March on Washington. What was the date of that? You guys should remember this, right? October 6th, 1943. 200 rabbis marched from Union Station to the Capitol, from there to the Lincoln Memorial, and from there to the White House. And again, if you remember, that's where Roosevelt refuses to see them. His staff member says, "I don't want to write." He says, Roosevelt asked his Jewish counsel, Samuel Rosenman, who are these demonstrators? He responds, I unsuccessfully tried to stop their coming since they really represent no one. And instead, he's given a meeting with the Vice President, Henry Wallace. And there you have Rabbi Elazar Silver reading a declaration to Henry Wallace, who looks very, very happy to be there listening to that at that moment in time. So again, Rabbi Elazar Silver is dedicating himself, Yomam Valayla, to saving rabbis. Eventually, it becomes not just about saving rabbis, but it becomes about saving everyone once they get more information and a better sense of what exactly is going on. I want to share with you some excerpts. So if you take the packet that I gave you, okay, this is Rabbi Elazar Silver writing in his own words. And I want to share a couple of excerpts just because I think it gives a context to everything we're talking about, and I think it gives you a little bit of a flavor for his passion for the Vat Hatzalah. He says the following, page number 13. But the chief obstacle was, in my opinion, to be found in the feelings of despair and impotency. Some asked, what can we do? How is it possible to organize help for distant and isolated Jewish communities with the war raging, all the challenge of communication dislocated, and all contacts dangerous, even forbidden? In other words, so many Jews simply threw up their hands. They said, there's nothing we can do. He says, it seems to me in the next paragraph that the secret of success of the Vat Hatzalah and of some of its daring exploits is to be found in the power of belief and in the strength of faith in the Almighty. In other words, while everyone else simply threw up their hands and said, what can we do? Rabbi Elazar Silver believed that with effort, they would be able to accomplish, and lo and behold, they were enormously successful. If you turn the page, again, this is at a rabbinical conference special of the Vat Hatzalah. He says the following. This conference has been called for the specific purpose of considering ways and means to help the Jewish people who are now in distress and captivity. We must not despair, nor let us become weakened in our determination to rescue the remnants of Israel. Many periods in history were considered periods of destruction for the Jewish people and for Judaism, but always our people placed their trust in God and gave their lives to save the treasures of our Torah. Again, a Jew never has yeish throughout history. Why should we start now? Shvat, 1942, the next arrow, he says, many ask, to whom will we bring the help? Where are these people? I can answer this question with the news that the Shanghai refugees, again, the students of the Mir Yeshiva, are going by ship to Eretz Yisrael via India. Also, we have definite news about the refugees of Siberia, many great rabbis and scholars, as well as yeshiva students. We have received from them cables urging speedy assistance. We must send more help there for sustenance and rescue, for many of them could reach Eretz Yisrael, and we must do everything to find ways and means for their rescue. A great task is before us, to rescue the remnants of Israel, to save our rabbis, our great teachers, and the yeshiva students. We must arouse American Jewry and move the heart of the Jewish people. Millions of our fellow Jews hover between life and death. At such a time, who can describe the colossal destruction of the people of the Torah? Dot, 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 dot. Again, the next arrow. In a conference in 1942, I said with a bitter and trembling voice, you have to almost like close your eyes to picture being in America 1942. Rabbi Elazar Silver gets up there, bitter and trembling voice, screams, we are guilty. We are guilty for our brethren because we did not do enough to help the Vat Hatzalah. We will not be able to say with a clear conscience, our hands have not spilt this blood. Because there were times when there was no money in the treasury of the Vat Hatzalah. We could have saved Jewish souls, souls of Torah people by the thousands and tens of thousands. The outcry reached us, but we did not have the means to save them. We therefore must assemble together with the entire community and say, we are guilty. This meeting has been called for great and tremendous deeds. You get a sense of that fearlessness, of the guts, of the tenacity, of his desire in relentlessness to save as many Jews as possible. Page 35, I have the speech he gave to President Roosevelt, again, to the Vice President, but he says, to the President of the United States, Franklin D. Roosevelt, in the name of the God Almighty of the universe who commanded us in the Holy Torah, do not let the blood of your friend be spilled. We cry out in misery to the Lord. A voice is heard aloft, the voice of blood of our brethren. Pure souls in the hundreds of thousands, children, infants, and elders, men and women crying out to us, save us. How will we be able to stand and pray on the holy day, the Day of Atonement, knowing that we have not fulfilled our duty? Therefore, we come to you on the eve of this most holy day of ours, it was Erev Yom Kippur, to ask you with a broken heart, Mr. President, to hearken and to listen to the sighs of our brethren hovering between life and death under the evil hand of the cruel Nazis. And of course, we know tragically, Roosevelt was not interested in what Rabbi Eliezer Silver had to say. Page 56, 57, and 58, I think, are the most important of what I share with you here. And that is, he enumerates what he believes to be the achievements of the Vahr HaTzal. And he says the following. Number one, the raising of the prestige of the Torah and the rabbinate. In this terrible era of catastrophe and destruction, it became obvious to everyone that the rabbis, the standard bearers of Torah and tradition, the great scholars and heroes of our faith, were the real leaders of the Jewish people. It is they who perceive first the anguish of the nation. It is they who are active and activate others for the salvation of the nation. In other words, he's very much aware that as a rabbi leading the call, leading the cause for the rescue of Jews of Europe, so that makes people look at rabbis in a different light. It makes them respect the rabbinate, that rabbis were willing to get their hands dirty to do whatever it took to save other Jews. Number two, the unity of the rabbis in the time of trial and persecution. The prestige of the rabbinate grew tremendously as a result of the decisive fact that the community of Orthodox rabbis were mobilized for the salvation of Israel as one united force. There is no reason to conceal the existence of certain differences of opinion and points of view. Many rabbis are leaders of religious parties competing with each other. But the power of the Vahr HaTzal was so strong that it created a united front of all rabbis, and it was strong enough to preserve this unity. Again, a theme which I think we're seeing in a number of different quotes for him. Number three, the external interventions of the rabbinate. I can hardly describe the magnitude or the effect of the appearance of our great rabbis as the bearers of the rescue demands before the rulers of America and the world at large. The fact that we, the rabbis of America, appear before heads of state in the name of the Jewish people, demonstrated to the whole world the true colors of the Jewish people, which despite the storms of the times, on the whole, remain true to the spirit of Jewish tradition. We cannot overestimate the positive results, moral and political alike, emerging from this fact. Number four, strengthening of Torah and bolstering of yeshivas. You can continue to read that on your own. Number five, unification of Orthodox Jewry in America. Right, again, that it brought together different types of Jews, young Israel, Agudas Yisrael. And lastly, six, the spiritual revival of the remnants. We cannot overestimate the spiritual influence of the activities of the Vahr HaTzal on the remnants of Israel in Europe immediately after the Holocaust. And that is where I want to transition in just a second. But first, I want to share one last story with you. One of the things that the Vahr HaTzal, again, to me, I shared those with you because you get a sense of his passion, of really his pride in what they were able to accomplish. The Vahr HaTzal worked day and night and even on Shabbos. This is a quote from Irving Bunim's biography. And it tells the following story of a plea on Shabbos for funds. Irving Bunim is having a Shabbos meal with his family. That was the only time of the week that was designated solely for his family. Seconds later, Rabbi Baruch Kaplan, head of Beis Yaakov Teacher Seminary, and Rabbi Eliezer Lynchner burst into his Borough Park house, troubled, breathless, arms akimbo. I don't know what that means. What's akimbo? Locked. Okay. Rabbi Lynchner recalled hearing Rabbi Shlomo Hyman renowned Rashiv of Torah Vadaah say that whenever there was a serious problem in the Torah-observant community, the first address should be Irving Bunim. Burnim's pleasure at seeing the two honor Rabbanim in his home turned into fear as Rabbi Kaplan began to speak. Bunim, quick! There's no time to waste. Rabbi Shlomo Hyman received a telegram from the Rosh Yeshiva who escaped Vilna. We have to get out 1,000 Rebbeim and Talmidim from Mir, Slobodka, Lubliner, Lubavitch, and other yeshivas, or the Russians will kill them. We have not given up on the rest, God forbid, but we have to help these Jews now. We have to raise $50,000 today. They have to get permits, secure visas, and book passages. We still have time. We can get them out to Japan, but the Russians will not let them go to Vilna without the cash. God forbid if we do not send them the money immediately, they will never escape. Bunim, the man whose Torah talks and fundraising speeches had moved thousands, sat speechless at his own table. Right? Like other Varatzala members, he'd been following the terrible events in Europe. But now, finally, a solution appeared miraculous, it seemed. Rabbi Lichtner gestured to the taxi cab sitting at the curb. Again, this is Shabbos. Rav Shlomo Hyman, Rav Moshe Feinstein, and Rav Shraga Feivel Mendelovitz, sent us to you. Right? The leading gedolim of that day and age in America sent these rabbis to Irving Bunim on Shabbos. We have to make a gewalt in Flatbush now. There's no time to wait until after Shabbos. Every day, every minute that we lose, we could lose these lives. Bunim sat stunned by the thought of riding in a taxi on Shabbos. He knew the Torah precept that saving the life supersedes all Torah law, but Shabbos is the core of Jewish life. Yet here were two of Brooklyn's most noted young Rabbanim speaking in the name of three Gedolim, commanding Bunim to violate Shabbos. He would give everything to preserve. Apologizing to his family, his cheeks wet with tears, Irving Bunim benched with great difficulty, cried again, and followed the two Rabbanim to the taxi. He and his companions were too upset to speak, and the cab sped on. Bunim checked the long list on his lap, gave the driver an address, and waited until the cab pulled over. Before anyone could speak, Bunim was running down the walk. There was no time to lose. His knock was loud, louder than the bell, which he was careful not to ring. Speaking to David Gewurzman would be hard, he knew. They needed so much money. Anyways, this guy opens the door. Bunim shifted his weight, bit his lip, upset that it had to happen this way. David Gewurzman smiled and opened the door. "Good Shabbos, Irving," he beamed, happy to see his friend from the textile business. "To what do I own the..." As Gewurzman paused and bewildered, getting out of a car and coming up the walk were a pair of Brooklyn's prominent young Rabbanim. "Rabbi Kaplan, Rabbi Lincher, what's going on? You came here by car? What are you trying to pull? Are you crazy?" Bunim shook his head gravely and took his friend by the arm. "Dave, this is an emergency. What do you think this is? A hospital? Where's the patient?" Bunim stared at his friend. "Are you through, Dave?" he said in a tone that stopped Gewurzman in mid-sentence. "Calm down and listen to me. If we don't move fast, 1,000 yeshiva students are going to be permanently trapped in Russia and killed." Anyways, by the end of the day, by the end of Shabbos, they had raised the $50,000 necessary to save those Jews of Mir and Slobodka and Lubavitch. I share this with you even though it doesn't directly have to do with Rabbi Lezer Silver, but it has everything to do with Rabbi Lezer Silver. That passion, that immediacy, was all the result of what Rabbi Lezer Silver had created, both in name by creating a Hatzalah and by creating an organization that was primed to be able to respond day and night, literally 24/7, to raising money for the Jews of Europe. After World War II, Rabbi Lezer Silver also is very influential in raising money, in raising efforts to promote the religious activities of the Jews in the DP camps. And he personally, in 1946, travels to Europe with $100,000 sewed into his coat. And wherever he went, he made a condition. He said, "I'll give you $100, but only if you promise that you will remarry and rebuild your life again. That was his sole desire, was that people rebuild in the aftermath of the Holocaust. Here you have Rabbi Lezer Silver in a DP camp. You'll notice that he's not dressed as a rabbi, but he is dressed as a chaplain, right? He was given permission by Eisenhower to go in a military garb, which would both open doors to him throughout Europe and B, prevent any anti-Semitism. I'm going to share with you a quote from Rabbi Emanuel Rachman, who is stationed as a chaplain in the American Air Force. This was a letter to Rabbi David Silver, Mrs. Malcolm Morris's father, dated August 8, 1946, writing about his interaction with Rabbi Eliezer Silver, David Silver's father. He says the following: "Your father arrived here on Monday and left last night. I did all I could to make him comfortable, but how your mother couldn't force him to stay in the States is beyond me. He is living on Torah, not food, and he is lecturing beyond the capacity of any five humans half his age. He did say he fared better in Zeilheim than any other camp he visited, but as luck would have it, half the time he was here, he fasted. The very little things I was able to do for him made me very happy, but I was worried, as well as inspired, by his enterprise and locomotion. He may come via Frankfurt again in a week, but I pray that he doesn't get to Palestine and goes home instead for rest." Guess what he does? Goes to Palestine, right? He travels an enormous amount. But I share that with you just to show the literally indefatigable efforts that he put in while in Europe, literally not sleeping, starving, not eating anything, because he just wanted to teach as much as possible. He wanted to share as much Torah. He wanted to give chizik to the remnants, to the Sheir Saplita, those who were left after the Holocaust. One of the Jews that he meets is an individual by the name of Simon Wiesenthal. And I want to read the story of Simon Wiesenthal. Simon Wiesenthal was very turned off to Judaism at that point. And the reason why he was turned off to Judaism is because he was in the Mauthausen death camp, and a Jew came, some of you might know the story, but a Jew came with a sitter, and he basically sold the sitter. He said, "I'll give you my sitter if you give me some food." And Simon Wiesenthal saw that and thought it was such a bizayon, what a chutzpah. He says, "I don't want a part of that Judaism anymore." Anyways, Simon Wiesenthal meets Rabbi Lezer Silver. And their story is recorded by Simon Wiesenthal as follows. He said, "That night, Rabbi Silver came to see me. He was a small man who wore an American army uniform without insignia. He had a small white beard, and his bright eyes shone with great kindness. He must have been at least 75, but his mind was sharp, and his voice was youthful. He told me that he'd been born in the Ukraine, a country of pogroms, and had emigrated as a boy to America, the country of hope. He put his hand on my shoulder. 'So they tell me you're angry with God,' he said in Yiddish. I responded, 'I am not with God, but with one of his servants,' and told him what had happened to me. He kept smiling. 'And that's all you have to tell me? Isn't that enough?' Rabbi asked. 'You silly man,' he said. 'So you look only at the bad man who took something from the good ones? Why don't you look instead at the good men who gave something to the bad one?' He touched me with his outstretched palm and left. I went to the service that day. Ever since, I've tried to remember that there are two sides to every problem, although sometimes it is as difficult to see the other side as the other side of the moon." Again, a beautiful interaction. Shows you the sweetness, the gentleness, the sharpness of Rabbi Eliezer Silver. Parenthetically, he lost 35 pounds while traveling overseas. Also while overseas, arguably the most famous story about Rabbi Eliezer Silver is he visits orphanages. Jewish children that were taken in by Christians. And what does he do? We all know the story. He says the Shema with them as these young children start crying for their Ima, for their Abba. And Rabbi Eliezer Silver is able to save hundreds and hundreds of little children as a result of that as well. It is important that he wasn't just involved in the Varatzala, but he was involved in numerous other philanthropic efforts as well. I share them with you because I think it shows his diversity. It shows his ability to operate in multiple different worlds. So for example, he raises $50,000 for the Panovich Yeshiva. Rav Kahneman calls him one of the three American angels. The other two were enormously wealthy businessmen. And the third is Rabbi Elazar Silver, raising $50,000 for the Panovich Yeshiva. He raises money when Rav Kook is starting Yeshivat Merkaz Harav. He raises money to help found the Yeshiva. The Friedrich Rebbe, who you have a picture of Rabbi Elazar Silver in the Friedrich Rebbe, the previous Lubavitch Rebbe, right? Lubavitch Rebbe's father-in-law. So he helps him raise money as well. He raises money for Stephen Wise. Stephen Wise, he raises money for him as well, for the resettlement of Jews in Palestine, right? Which I think is important to point out. Rav Kasher, author of the Torah Shlema, great multi-volume work, needed some help funding his volumes. He looks to Rav Elazar Silver, the Dvar Avram. Rav Avram Shapiro of Kovna, beautiful work on Gemara, Lamdisha work. Again, he raises the money for that as well. I share that with you because I want to show you the diversity, again, the diversity of the worlds that he was able to operate within. And lastly, I would like to point out that he did have an enormous love for the land of Israel. He writes in January 24th, 1949, this is at the annual convention of the Aguda. Again, it was a different Aguda back then. He says, it is a time of joy of the entire Jewish nation. These feelings must now take the place of great pain we have felt since the unparalleled tragedies of the Holocaust. Nevertheless, we must now rejoice in pride as the Jewish people establishes its dominion over the Holy Land. Even those of us who live afar are constantly concerned with the happenings of our brethren in Israel. Their joy, holidays, and worry are ours. We will rejoice with trembling as we have been accustomed to in the past. That is the life of Rabbi Elazar Silver. What I tried to show you tonight is an individual who is engaging, who, as his granddaughter describes him, was warm, friendly. Malki described him always as a twinkling in his eye. But someone who was fearless, tenacious, not afraid to do whatever it took to accomplish what he felt was the most important thing to do. Someone who, on the one hand, operated in the world of the Aguda, of Rav Chaim Moser Grzinski, of the great Gedolim of Europe, but someone who was also able to be a part of Mizrahi and sought to fuse the two of them and to overcome whatever political differences there were for the greater good of the Jewish people. A Gadol who not just learned by the great Gedolim of Europe, of Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk, of Rav Chaim Moser, of the Rugachever, of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, right? But also came to America and became a Gadol B'Torah in America. Someone who was able to mesmerize people with his erudition, with his Talmudic discourses, but not only didn't view it beneath him, but viewed it as his calling to roll up his sleeves when the Jewish people needed it most, to get his hands dirty and to raise money yomam valayla. And that, to me, is the most magnificent fusion of what we look for in a gadol. This was not an ivory tower gadol. Ivory tower gadolim come to America post-World War II, and it changes the face of America. When the European rabbis come, the aguda changes, the American rabbinate changes. The power, so to speak, is taken from pulpit rabbis and given over to yeshivas, which, again, we could talk about more at length in another time. What mesmerized me in my learning about Rav Elazar Silver was, here you have someone who could walk with the Gedolim, who did walk with the Gedolim. I shared with you the recommendation from Rav Chaim Moser Grudzinski, had the acclaim of the greatest of the European rabbis, who had a close relationship with Rabbi Soloveitchik and all the American rabbanim, and yet never, not only didn't view it beneath him, but viewed not as a steer, not as a contradiction, but as a compliment to his role as a gadol, someone who is willing to get his hands dirty on behalf of Klal Yisrael, whether that's with kashrus, whether that was with mila, whether that was with mikvah, whether that was fighting the reform movement and battling assimilation, whether that was with the Vahd Hatzalah. Right? He never viewed it beneath him to be politically active. And for me, I'll just share personally, I found that enormously inspiring. enormously inspiring. In our day and age, we have Gedolim, and we have pulpit rabbis, right? It's rare that you find such a fusion of the two. Someone who is an activist, someone who's politically involved, someone who is not scared to raise money on behalf of other Jews, but also someone who remains true to tradition, who remains true to his heritage as a true Gadol Batorah. And that is, in a nutshell, I hope I shared with you, I hope I inspired you a little bit. Again, I want to thank Malka Morris for sharing with me a little bit about her grandfather. She has up here, for those who want, a picture from her house of her grandfather, Rabbi Elazar Silver. We have a picture here of him as well. We're not sure who the other people in the picture are, but this certainly is an animated conversation. The Biana Rebbe is on the this side. We're not sure who's in the middle, but if anyone knows, I know the Morris family would be appreciative as well. But certainly you see the animation in his face. Whatever the conversation is, he's clearly very excited about it. And again, I hope I gave us a little bit of an insight into his life, but more importantly, all of us leave just a little bit more inspired that if he can do all that he did on behalf of the Jewish people, then certainly so can we.